So that's Genesis chapter 6, starting at verse 1. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord.
Thanks, Sarah, and good morning, everyone. My name is Cam Maxwell, if we haven't met, one of the pastors here at Tonsley. These are confronting words, aren't they, that we just had read? The creator of the universe has examined the state of humanity, and he's deeply troubled. In this passage, there are some things that are not that clear, but what is definitely clear is that as God examines humanity, he sees wickedness and he sees evil. Today we're in the second major section of the Bible. Chapters 1 to 4 are sort of like section number 1. Chapter 5 started with a new section and a new focus. We saw last week at the start of chapter 5 a new section heading. This is the account of Adam. That heading, this is the account of, is how the author of Genesis signals we're at a new section, a new part of Genesis. So today we're in section 2. And in section 2 of the Bible has two big ideas about humanity. Last week, big idea 1 is that we all die. Today, the big idea is that we are evil. If it's the first time you've joined us today, welcome. It's really great you can be with us. And if you're hoping for a feel-good sort of a theme this morning, I'm afraid this won't be it. The reason we're looking at this sobering passage is that we're committed here to read carefully everything the Bible has to say. Because God has chosen to use the Bible to tell us all we need to know, everything we need to know in the Bible about him, about our world, and about ourselves. And if we were to just ignore or to skip over the confronting or the strange bits, it's actually kind of dangerous. It would be like, I suppose, refusing to go to the doctor for help, or just pretending everything's okay when we know it's probably not, and then just not listening to the bad news if the doctor gave it to us, just refusing to listen. Today, we'll see it's so important because we'll see there really is a cure. There really is a cure for this problem, but we do need to first understand the reality and the gravity of the human situation. So if we want to find a proper solution, we need to know what our problem is. And who better to give us a thorough examination than the Creator, the God who made us? So far, actually, in Genesis, the picture that's been painted of being human, it's actually not that bad. It's been pretty good overall. Genesis 1 and 2, better than okay. It's actually the high point showing us what humans are. Genesis 1 and 2 shows us that humans are the highlight of all creation. God's proudest achievement in creating was not waterfalls, not galaxies, it's us. We are the high point of creation, and it's because God has made us in his image. Humans are precious, we are valuable, not simply just a bunch of cells kind of existing for a while. Human life, in God's eyes, is precious. We bear the image of God himself. So Genesis started by saying the best thing that could be said about being human. But it's also said and been very clear about our biggest failure. Our biggest failure is not how we treat the environment. It's not even how we treat each other. It's that we have failed to treat God as God. We have rejected our Creator and refused to let him rule over our lives. Instead, we've chosen to go our own way, deciding for ourselves what's right and what's wrong. That is, in the language of the Bible, we have sinned. And we realize from Genesis, the way Genesis sort of works, we realize once you fail to treat God as God, it's a snowballing problem. Things just get worse and worse from there. If we fail to treat God as God, we fail to look after creation. We fail in our relationships with each other. Now, that's the story of humanity, and it's actually our story too. This is our diagnosis. In the language of Genesis, we are evil. We are wicked. That's the language here in verse 5. But even though I say that out loud, you realize that is such a foreign way to speak in this world, isn't it? We don't use the language like evil freely. We tend to reserve words like evil just for the worst kind of people. You know, Hitler, mass murderers, people who travel at 80 on the freeway, like just very exclusive bunch. These are blunt words for us, aren't they? And God doesn't sugarcoat it. But that's helpful. It means we can be crystal clear on our condition, what our greatest problem is. If we are human, the diagnosis is we are wicked, no matter how hard we try. That's God's assessment. Now, once we're clear on that problem, we can actually move towards a solution for that problem, an incredible solution that God provides. Now, before diving into all of that, and verse 5 really will be our key verse today, but before we dive into that, I'm sure you're wondering, as we're reading, what is happening in verses 1 to 4? There's some strange things going on. There's all kinds of questions we might ask as we read verses 1 to 4 of chapter 6. So do keep your Bible open. Before I dive in, though, it's worth saying I think it's important not to get too sidetracked by the sort of questions we might have and to focus on what the main thing in this passage is. The main thing happening in verses 1 to 4 is that we're seeing in the earliest days evil was growing in the world, and that God is right to take charge of things so that evil didn't get worse. That's what we're seeing in verses 1 to 4. Evil was growing, and God is right to take charge. So have a look. Verse 1, humans are increasing in number. And then verse 2, we read, "The sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful and married any of them they chose." Who are these sons of God? There are two main sort of theories about who these sons of God might be. One theory is that they could be royalty, human royalty of some sort. Elsewhere, kings are described often as sons of God. And so if that's the case, the problem here, what's wrong, is that these kings are marrying more than one woman each, a polygamy. Could be that. But the other main theory about who these sons of God are is that they are some sort of spiritual being, some sort of angel or fallen angel of some sort. In fact, if you're taking notes, note down Job chapter 1. You could go and have a look at Job chapter 1 later. You'll see there's a heavenly gathering of angels around the throne of God. And there, the angels are called sons of God. So here in Genesis, it could be there is some sort of fracture, actually, some sort of mixing between the physical world that we're part of and the spiritual world that we don't get to see normally. Now, that, of course, it sounds very odd to us, doesn't it? Angels coming and marrying women. But what Genesis reminds us over and over again is that this world, this physical world we see and touch, it's not all there is. Genesis tells us over and over again, this world is more than just the physical. And if you jump to the New Testament, we realize, well, if God himself is able to come into this world, born of a human, well, it reminds us, doesn't it, all the time, as we've read the Bible, our world exists alongside a spiritual one with supernatural realities that sort of overlap with our natural world regularly. So the sons of God, if they are some sort of angelic beings, there is obviously a problem with them marrying the humans. But what is that problem? And there's perhaps a few clues here to help us work out what's going on. It's not heaps obvious in our translations, I don't think, but the kind of language in verse 2 goes, the sons of God saw that the daughters were good, and they took. They saw it was good, and they took. Now, that's the same language we read back in Genesis chapter 3 as Eve looks at the forbidden fruit. Back in chapter 3, she saw it was good, and so she took it. So just like with Eve, here there is a reaching past the boundaries that God has set, reaching beyond what should have been done, perhaps reaching for being like God himself. We might also miss this a little bit in our modern setting, but it says here they are marrying human girls. That is, these are relationships that are approved and are blessed by their parents. There's no other sort of marriage in the ancient world. So perhaps the big issue here is that humans are happily, intentionally marrying off their daughters to these angelic beings, if that's what they are, thinking that mixing these marriages with these supernatural beings, maybe they can find immortality. Maybe they can escape death that we read about last week. Again, this would be a reaching beyond the boundaries God has set, a reaching out to be like God. Now, I want to say that's a tentative understanding of what's going on here. The author doesn't really spell it out exactly. But I guess if that is the crime, seeking for immortality one way or another, if that is the crime, God's punishment is fitting, isn't it? As he limits lifespans. Now, whatever is happening, it's clear enough, this isn't good, whatever is going on. The point is, humans are growing in rebellion. They're trying to get around the curse of death because in verse 3, God responds. Verse 3, the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal." That word mortal could actually be also corrupt. They are corrupt. So God then announces their days will be 120 years. Last week we saw that the problem of death just hangs over us, doesn't it? And last week we saw that was a real problem. Here we're seeing that it's God himself who is in charge of our days and the limit of them. We're being reminded we are mortal. We are not like him. Our life is sustained by his spirit. And so if he was to remove his spirit at any moment, we are done for. So God is saying here, I won't let them live forever. I can't bear to do that. Because they are not immortal like me. They are corrupt. Now, I think this is a crucial insight about how to actually think well about death. It's to be reminded that all death is in God's hands. No matter how someone may die, be it in a flood or a catastrophe or a war, or perhaps peaceably in old age, during sleep. No matter how God chooses to remove his spirit, now, we may get angry, we may be outraged that God will allow a bad thing to happen to someone, but alongside that, we must remember, or ought to try and remember, that each human life is not its own thing. We are not independent beings. We only exist, we only live by the sustaining spirit of God. Now, does God owe anyone life? Does God owe me a long, happy life? Does he owe me another day tomorrow? Actually, no, he doesn't. It's uncomfortable, but it's very helpful to be reminded there is nothing we can do about that. Our life is entirely in God's hands, and so is our death. It's a sobering passage, but it does helpfully remind us that we are beyond self-help. Even in this announcement that our days will be 120 years, it sounds bleak, but actually we realize there's mercy in this. There's two main ways you can understand this 120-year limit. Both of these actually make sense. The first way, God's saying here, we're going to limit lifespan to 120 years. And then it's about 120 years later that he sends the floodwaters and the judgment that comes next week. So it could be this 120 years is a delay of judgment that God's talking about. The other way to look at it, like we see from here on in Genesis, the very long lifespans we touched on last week, they start winding down to eventually be more like 120 years. It doesn't happen straight away, so perhaps God is introducing that limit sort of gradually here, 120 years. Now, either way it makes sense of Genesis, 120 years before the flood or 120 years as a limited lifespan, and either way, there's more than a hint of mercy, isn't there? Because if it's 120 years pause before judgment, well, that's 120 years to get our life together, to fix up, to repent. Or if it's a 120-year lifespan limit, limiting human life to no more than that, I guess if you think about it this way, how bad would it be if people didn't stop living after 120 years? If it's true that we are evil, that we are wicked, can you imagine how much chaos someone could cause over 1,000 years? How much damage there'll be done in relationships, the environment, the world around us, as wickedness grows in that person's lifetime for 1,000 years. It seems limiting lifespans is actually a mercy to our world. But probably also wondering, what about the Nephilim? Who are they? What's going on with them? And you won't be surprised to hear me say, I hope, that I don't really know. We can't be too certain about this. The word probably means something like giants, as best we can kind of tell. And whoever they are, it's not exactly spelled out clearly, but they seem to be the result of the sons of God marrying human women. So the point being made about the Nephilim, whoever they are, is that this time before the flood was a different sort of time. Similar, yeah, similar but different. So even for ancient Israelites, reading Genesis as it came hot off the press, the first people to read Genesis, even for Israelites reading about the Nephilim, they're reading about a time that was ancient for them, strange and mysterious, the heroes of old they've kind of heard a little bits about. As we'll see, Noah will be the bridge between that old world with the mysterious heroes and the way, world that ancient Israel found themselves in, which is the world we know. Now, in the old world, the ancient world, and today, our modern world, the verdict of God when it comes to humanity, it's the same. Back in chapter 1, as God first created the world, we read over and over again, God saw what he'd made and it was good. He saw and it was good. He saw and it was good. And now, look with me again at verse 5. What does God see now? The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Perhaps the most devastating statement about humanity anywhere. This idea that human wickedness, it's universal. It's everywhere. It's widespread. It's all over the earth. It's thorough. It taints absolutely everything. That phrase, every inclination was only evil. And it's constant. It's only evil all the time. There's no end in sight here. And it's internal. The way it phrases every inclination of the thoughts, inclination is a word about forming or planning or making things. The phrase is saying we invent ways to do evil. In our way, we're quick to discount evil as an actual thing. We tend to talk about mistakes being made or someone's context or background or psychology sort of explaining why they behave in certain ways. We might talk about greed or jealousy as problems, often problems out there that other people have. But this speaks more than all of that, that evil lies within, and it lies within all of us. Now, it's not saying people can't do good things, because of course, people can do good things. People can do incredible and very good things. What this is saying, though, is that through everything good, through every good intention, there's going to be some sort of stain or taint because of something evil. Even the best deed, the most generous act, may have self-interest or pride riddled all through it. Because remember, the biggest failure for humanity is the failure to treat God as God. So anything, thought, deed, or intention of the heart, anything we do or think that fails to honour God perfectly is twisted or it's wrong. I realise this is not at all what we get taught in schools about ourselves. It's not what we get taught at uni in humanities classes. This is not what we hear on podcasts about psychology or culture. And we might be tempted today to write off God's assessment of humanity. You know, this is just typical Old Testament God, so angry and judgmental. Except that we see the same thing over and over again in the New Testament. And instead of writing it off, maybe it would be helpful to consider that, well, is it possible that this actually explains our world? This diagnosis actually explains our world far better than anything else? So you think, what is wrong with our world? I don't think it can be that we just haven't educated people enough. If anything, the last century has taught us education and science and technology just gives us opportunities to do more violence, to be more greedy, to be more self-interested. I don't think the problem seems to be that we just need a better political model or a better economic system, because every system depends on people. That's why there is no utopia to look forward to built by human hands. I don't think our problem is that we just need moral reform. Like, we need to teach kids better manners, better behaviour. We don't just need stricter punishment for those who cheat or lie or steal. Because if the issue is within us, there's no amount of behaviour or therapy or threats that's going to fix what's internal. So doesn't this picture of humanity, you know, beautiful at one level, made in the image of God, but also twisted and evil in our own ways, doesn't that make sense of history? Seeing the best and the worst. Doesn't it make sense of the news? Doesn't it make sense of ourselves? And this is the hard bit, you know, holding up the mirror or sitting down at the doctor's after the scans and saying, okay, oh, doctor, tell me, give it to me straight. What's wrong with me? So even if we feel like a good person, do we sometimes find ourselves, say, get jealous when a sibling or a colleague does better than us or has something go well for them? We might be happy for them, but also just a bit jealous. Do we sometimes do something really generous or kind or sacrificial and I think, gee, I hope someone else saw that? As we check our bank accounts, as we see, you know, the salary or income come in, are we instantly, without even thinking about it, thanking God for his kind, abundant provision? Or do we sometimes feel in our hearts a bit like Gollum from the Lord of the Rings? Like, am I precious? See, this is a brutal diagnosis. And even our own reaction to it can be instructive. If we're resistant to hearing this diagnosis, it probably tells us that it's probably true. We spend so much of our life, I think, projecting an image of ourselves to others and convincing ourselves sometimes that we're decent and lovely and kind, but there are moments when in the quiet of our heart we know it's mostly fake news. This is God's assessment of humanity. This is his diagnosis. So how are you feeling after all of that? Makes you want to sort of stay in bed sometimes hearing this, I think. And there are, of course, all kinds of important questions. There are ways we might want to nuance this, of course. But unless we want to be able to, are able to step back and say, well, look, even if I don't like it, God is in the best position to make that diagnosis. Unless we can accept that, well, we don't struggle to find a solution, won't we? So if we can accept that diagnosis, we're not going to waste time fluffing around with things that won't help, things that won't cure us. When we have the accurate diagnosis, we can get the right treatment. And the good news here is that verses 6 to 8 actually move us in that direction. As we see the response of God to this verdict, it's actually a profound response as we sort of dig into it. It's a life-changing response as we grasp what God is doing here. In verse 6, I think we get a wonderful insight into the heart of God. It's hard, but it's helpful. So often in the Bible, we get to read about what God says. We read about what God does. But sometimes there are some wonderful passages that tell us how God feels, what he thinks. And these are especially helpful passages. Verse 6. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. Other translations have that he was deeply grieved or bitterly grieved. It's a weird thing, isn't it, to say that God has regrets? Like God who knows the future, he knows all things, he's in control of all things, every detail is in his hands. How does he regret? Well, however God regrets things, it must be in a way that's kind of different to how we regret. After all, God doesn't make mistakes. It's not like me regretting that one extra piece of pizza. Yeah, I should have quit while I was ahead. Or some of you regretting now you didn't grab that extra blanket that you should have, you were warned about. God knew this would come, but still. I think what we're seeing in this passage is that God genuinely holds us responsible. Yes, he is in charge of all things. He is sovereign. He is the ruler of every detail of the universe. But he is sovereign in such a way that we are rightly held responsible. So whatever we can say about God repenting, here it involves God acting. He's making a change in direction. That is, God gets to the point where he must act. Sin and evil, wickedness, it troubles him, it deeply grieves him. Many of us here in this room from our earliest days have learned about sin. We've read the Bible, we've heard in kids' church that sin is bad. Yes, that's true. Why is sin bad? Is it just bad because God says it's bad? Well, yes, but there's more, isn't there? Think about this. Why is my sin bad? What's actually wrong with it? Sin is wrong. It does deserve punishment, yes. But at the end of the day, sin is so wrong because it grieves God. It deeply troubles him. My sin, your sin, it grieves God. He's not just wagging a finger at some arbitrary rule. He cares. And so our sin is profoundly relational. It grieves and it wears on our holy and perfect Creator. And even though his patience is literally godlike, sin is so bad that even the most patient, loving being imaginable, he can't endure it forever. God simply cannot allow evil to exist. He must have things right. Because only that fits with his own holiness, his own perfection. So in verse 6, the grief of God triggers a new moment in world history. He acts as the holy God who must have things right. He acts in judgment, but he also acts as the God who loves with mercy and grace. If we're able to accept our diagnosis, the two ways God responds here instructs us what our options are. If that's our diagnosis, there are only two pathways God puts before every single one of us. It's either judgment or it's grace. In verse 7, we get the announcement that God will rid the world of humans. And at first, we read that, it sounds total, like a total reversal of all his creating work. It's like he's going to take the world back to a watery, lifeless, chaotic existence. God's judgment here, it is to uncreate. It's no half measure, showing us that evil is not a small problem. Let's read verse 7. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. Now, why animals? What have they done to deserve this? Well, Genesis has made very clear that humanity is to rule over the created world, over creatures. So realizing again that human evil is an absolute disaster for the whole world. And in God's plans, there is actually no point having animals in a world where there are no humans. Animals are for humans to rule over. That's why they exist. No humans, no animals. It's also so confronting, isn't it? Such a confronting verse. It's alarming just what this scale tells us about how big a problem evil is, because God is dealing it with such a radical way. It must be a huge problem, right? But judgment is not the final word here. Verse 7 might lead us to think he's going to throw out the whole human project, but no. We get to verse 8. Very next verse, we see there's a plot twist. And we're told here, as it kind of unwinds from here in the rest of Genesis, it tells us there is another way, verse 8, there is another way that evil does not have to end up in our judgment. There is mercy on offer. The doctor has told us your problem is fatal, and at this point we could try and cure ourselves, we could try and slap a band-aid on a mortal wound, or we could listen as the great physician goes on to tell us it is fatal unless I do something to help you. And here it is. Verse 8, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Last week we're told that the name Noah, it means comfort or relief, and we'll read more about Noah next week. But the mention here in this passage, it is our comfort, it is our relief this morning, because Noah is a sign for us of God's mercy. Noah goes on to be the way that God rescues humanity from his judgment. Noah is, I guess, the bridge from this old world and the world we're in, and he's the one that offers life through judgment and beyond judgment. And here is someone, Noah, in a way that gives us hope. Here is someone who finds favor in the Lord's eyes. There is someone. What we see in Noah is a foretaste of the relief and the comfort that Jesus brings from God's judgment. Because as we keep reading our Bibles, we get to the New Testament, we see Jesus. And we realize that God's assessment of humanity in the New Testament is the same. It's the same as this. It's as blunt as today that there is no one righteous, that we've all fallen short, that we all deserve the judgment of God. The New Testament tells us all these things, that by rights, we are already dead in our sin. But just like Noah finds favor in God's eyes, Jesus, the eternal Son of God, he finds perfect favor in God's eyes, because he's the perfect, sinless, righteous one. More than just that, Jesus offers each one of us the chance to be seen by God, no longer as evil, no longer as wicked, but we get a whole new assessment. So we turn to Jesus, his good favor with the Lord gets passed on to us. We get a whole new clean bill of health. And we too, through trusting in Jesus, find this same favour in the eyes of God, not through trying hard, not by trying to be really good, but just simply by putting our trust in Jesus, accepting the mercy on offer. All our evil, when we do that, all our evil, all our wickedness, God sees no more because it's dealt with entirely on Jesus' death on the cross. It's in his great love that God, who is rich in mercy, he offers us salvation and he offers us life in Christ. He offers to forgive and wipe clean all our wickedness and to then see in us only what he sees in Jesus, righteousness, goodness. God's assessment is bleak, but it's not his final word. God is patiently holding out to each and every person mercy and grace and the favour that Jesus has in his eyes he offers to extend to us, meaning that in Christ there is no fear of any remaining judgment. This is a confronting passage, and the diagnosis we have is not pleasant to dwell in, it's not pleasant to consider, but I hope you can see how important it is to be aware of how God sees us and how much danger we would be in if we simply try to fix this ourselves. We must have complete reliance on God's mercy, providing a way for us to be saved. And he does that freely in Jesus. Genesis 6 has given us a clear announcement that our sin grieves God, but it also gives us a sure hope that our God loves us so much that he's made a wonderful way to save us from his right judgment.